This is from John's Gospel, chapter 15. As the Father has loved me, Jesus said, so have I loved you. Abide in my love. These things I've spoken to you that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be full. Each Sunday in the season of Advent revolves around a kind of emotional theme: hope, peace. And this text mentions both of the last two: abide in my love, which is the theme for next Sunday, and today, abide in his love such that his joy may be full in our lives. His joy. Joy and happiness are not the same thing. Joy is transcendent of happiness. Happiness is the result of circumstance. Good things happen, that makes me happy. I expect to have a big plate of smoked ribs at the Salt Lick restaurant in Austin tomorrow night. That makes me happy. Tech wins a football game, that makes me happy. Lots of things make me happy. I get a Christmas card, makes me happy. Joy, however, is more foundational to that. There is often great joy in circumstances that give us great pain. Joy is a foundational experience when we get through it and when we cope. One of the things that's happened to us in the last month is we had a chance to visit an area that had been devastated and out of which, I believe, has come joy. Our oldest stepson's in-laws, if you can follow that, live in Washington, Illinois, which was the town that was flattened by a tornado about a month ago. And because we're family, we got a chance to go through and visit with Andrew's in-laws. Their home was damaged. The roof will need to be replaced, and they lost their chimney, but it was livable, and they had heat and water and all of that. So we were able to visit. But in so doing, unlike anyone who didn't live there or know someone who did, we could drive around the neighborhood. Their house was literally 100 yards from houses that had been reduced to toothpicks, and that whole neighborhood was like that. It was a stunning and sobering experience to have a chance to see that and to be grateful for the blessing in our family, but also to understand that it was completely random chance that their home was not lost. Now, one of the stories that came out of that particular tornado, and there are millions of these every time something like this happens, was something that was found 150 miles away in or near a train station in Chicago. Somebody just was wandering through that area and reached down and picked up a middle school identification card of someone who went to Washington Junior High, 150 miles away, essentially unscathed. And through Facebook and all manners of other things, I guess, that we have these days, found the person and then made the trip back to East Peoria, Illinois, and had this big reunion, wound up on TV, and it's certainly on YouTube now, you can find it. This sort of joyful reunion, not with as much the people, but this ID card, this identity, this thing that prevailed. You know, and what's implied in my mind is that identity is important, and it in fact can give us joy when we recapture who we are after our lives have been turned upside down, in this case, quite literally. Identity. Who are we? What are we about? How do we relate as people who are identified? There is joy in identity. That's what I want to talk about today. There is joy in various types of identities that we all have. I think we have at least three types. The first I would call transactional identities. These are the things that are job titles. They're the things that are on business cards, that are things that are nameplated to office doors. When somebody asks you what you do, this is a kind of transactional identity. I teach classes and write papers and so on. And in return, well, the checks keep cashing. The checks keep cashing, so I keep on doing this. There's a give and take and a back and forth. Which is not to say that that's something wrong with that. I mean, career counseling I do from time to time in sort of ad hoc ways with some of my students is very simple. I say to them, discover what it is you love to do And then learn how to do that well enough such that you can convince someone to pay you to do it. Do what you can and what you're about and contribute in this way. These are transactional identities. My role as professor gives me a chance to transact in a couple of really interesting ways, and a couple of them happened just in these last few weeks. The guy that hired me, who gave me the opportunity to transact professing, retired. And this is our first semester without him, and I kind of miss him. And at his retirement dinner, I remember speaking, because that's what I do, and I said, this was a guy who not only hired me on the phone, sight unseen, for 1 year, and then I had to work it out more permanently. But I hadn't been in and around the office more than a month or so when he kind of called me in and he said, you know, all of us have to do research, and I've got this data set in this drawer. It's interview transcripts and some tapes, and I'm just tired of it. And he handed me this box of stuff and said, if you want to make something out of this stuff, list me as second author and you get a paper out of it. I said, that's great. So I did. Turns out it was an article that detailed the evolution of what's become Fourth on Broadway in Lubbock to what it had been originally, which was a kind of ecumenical social outreach initiative. And it was a little article that got published in a journal that you never heard of and got cited by six other people in 20 years. But without it, I don't think I'd get tenure. It was a good little article, and he did that for no other reason than that's what we do when we transact our role as colleagues. I thought about him when I discovered the other day, in the result of this going around the country research project that we've been doing the last 3 years, I have a drawer full of data that I really don't want to deal with. It's just one qualitative piece of it. But I have a colleague who's in her first year, just first semester with us now, who's really good at dealing with this kind of data. So I just pulled the drawer out and dumped it in a box and went down to her office and said, here, there's a box of stuff I don't want to deal with. Make it an article, leave me second author, have fun. Transacting in Paul's honor, in a sense, paying it forward. Similarly, this week, one of our grad students, a student I had in class about a year ago, told me that she had decided finally, and sort of at the last minute, she's going to apply to doctoral programs, and she told me which four she was applying to and asked me to write a letter. And I looked at the four, and I thought, well, those are programs. They're good enough programs. I said, why don't you apply to Purdue? I know a guy up there, and you're interested in medical sociology. And she said, my GRE scores aren't good enough to get me into Purdue. I said, what are they? And she told me, and I said, let me make some calls. You know, they weren't horrible, but they weren't, you know, light it up. Now, I also know that GRE scores are not the know-all, be-all, end-all. In fact, as far as some schools go, they don't mean anything, not so at Purdue. But anyway, they weren't all that much worse than mine. So I called up my friend and I said, here's this student that will come up and visit at her own expense if you want to have a look at her beyond what the GRE score. And he said, that's great. And I reminded him that she's not a lot different than I was, you know, 24 years ago when I landed up there and he pulled me out of his class and talked to me in a hall and said, you know, why don't you write this article with me? And that's become, I don't get promoted without that art. The whole thing. I don't know whether this grad student is ever going to get in. She might not. If she gets in, I don't know whether she'll finish. I don't know 20 years from now what she'll be about. But this scholar at Purdue, who was my teacher and is now my friend, and is one of the most widely known medical sociologists in the country, said, thanks for thinking of me. Thanks for thinking of me, he says to me. It's transacting. It's paying it forward. And that's the kind of identity that keeps the wheels on the world. There is joy, foundational joy. Whether this girl makes anything of a career in sociology, I found great joy in my friend Ken saying, thanks for thinking of me. And that's how it's supposed to work, transactional identity. That's not the only kind, though. There are what I would call traditional identities that are not transactional. Sometimes they're wildly unfair. There's more give and less take, and that cycles in families. Now, sometimes traditional identities are very dramatic. If you happen to be born into the family that we know as the House of Windsor in London, well, that's a pretty big deal. But every family is in its own way a kind of big deal. I mean, we are named after those who name us, and there's a tradition that goes with that. I tell my freshmen, you know, this is how we define family. It's a group of people that are related to each other. And then we give the criterion by blood, by marriage, adoption. And then there's this little phrase that I think is maybe the most important. A group of people related by blood, marriage, adoption, or some other agreement. In other words, we can agree to be family. And that's what marriage is, really. It's an agreement that we then, you know, take people through a legal and sometimes religious process to formalize that commitment. But it essentially is an agreement to be family. I get a little annoyed sometimes when I hear good Christian people who I think their heart's trying to be in the right place say things like, well, the Bible's definition of family is one man and one woman and married to each other and that's it. And I go, what Bible are you reading? Take a look at Genesis 15 for a minute, the sordid story of Abraham and Hagar, his maid, and Ishmael, their son, etc. We can agree to be family. And Sarah, Abraham's wife, banished Hagar because of the sordidness of it. And God said, bring her back. We need her. We need Ishmael. Read the story. It's amazing. We can agree to be family. But don't take that lightly. Family, tradition, it's not always a fair deal. I went to church several years ago when I had a Sunday away, and I walked in and picked up the bulletin, and the title of the sermon that day was, The Church is Our Home. And I thought, great, I'm going to need an insulin shot when I get out of here. Church is our home, okay, cool. And the point of the sermon was, I'll never forget it, and it certainly brought me up short by my cynicism on the way in. Point one, home is where you go to be your nastiest. And then, quoting Robert Frost, home is where you go and they have to take you in. And that's kind of how it is, isn't it? We do go home to be our nastiest, and we go home where they have to take us in. And there are, you know, there are transactions that are involved with that emotionally, but at the end of the day, there's more often than not the taking of a breath and going, you know what, it's still worth it. That commitment, that history, that tradition, it's still worth it. And by the way, I know this was your day, you know, to sort of step in it, but my day will come. And we got in this for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer. And that's sometimes lost on us in a way. Because if you think about the wedding vows that are an example of how we can agree to be family, it says, till death us do part. And we sort of gloss over that part. And what it means essentially is that when you make this agreement, when you make this commitment, it's going to end horribly for one of you. And in retrospect, you'll have to decide whether it was worth it, and it always is. It always is because of tradition, because of commitment, because it's the place in our lives where God touches us the most profoundly. I don't know why I was doing this, but I've got old hymnals, and our hymnal is old, and we'll be replacing it soon. But like three hymnals ago, I was looking at the wedding ceremony, and in it, in the run-up to all wedding ceremonies, the minister gives a little speech about what it is that they're doing. This is what you're signing up for, is what this is about. And we've softened that over the years. We've gotten much more, you know, pink and blue and silver and sentimental about what marriage is. Not so three hymnals ago. There's this paragraph, and I'm quoting it as verbatim as I recall it. The minister says, "And although by reason of sin, many a cross hath been laid thereon." Talking about marriage now, or any kind of commitment. "Although by reason of sin, many a cross hath been laid thereon. Nevertheless, our gracious Heavenly Father doth not forsake His children in an estate so holy and vital to Him." God doth not forsake us, even though many a cross hath been laid thereon. And there is joy in what I would call not just transactional and traditional identities, but the one transcendent identity that Audrey and I talked about a minute ago, that of Christian. I don't know if you're paying attention. The song Joy to the World, which is a great song on the third Sunday in Advent, the theme of joy, a lot of churches leave out the third verse just by default. Pay attention to the third verse of Joy to the World. although many a cross hath been laid thereon, echoing that sentiment. No more let sins and sorrows grow, nor thorns infest the ground. That's harsh language. He comes to make his blessings flow far as the curse is found. And then, in case you didn't get it, far as the curse is found, far as the curse is found. In other words, where it's darkest and thorniest and sorrowful, that's where God meets us with a transcendent identity. And if you don't believe me, ask St. Peter, who remains today the rock on which the church is built, the first pope. St. Peter stepped in it pretty hard in the run-up to and in the aftermath of his Lord's death. He stepped in it really hard three times. And John records a meeting of the two of them afterward where, in a sense, Jesus gets all in his face and says, Simon Peter, do you love me? Three times he says it. I don't know, maybe that cancels out the denials. I don't know how that was written that way. But anyway, he says, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And Jesus says finally then, feed my lambs. What's implied by that? Simon Peter, who went far as the curse was found and cursed his Lord. Simon Peter is given the directive by the risen Jesus, you're still in the game. Feed my lambs. You still have something to give. There are people that need who you are. Get back in the game. Peter and Judas, I think, occupy the same category around that time. And the sad thing about Judas's story is not that he died, everybody dies, but that he died before he and Jesus could have a similar conversation. And we can only speculate about that. Judas dies in a couple of different ways in the Bible. I don't know which is factually accurate. It doesn't matter. But in one instance, he despairingly goes and takes his own life. And I think the answer to the question I get once in a while, did Judas go to heaven, is a resounding yes. Because I think if for no other reason, that's where Jesus was and they needed to have this conversation. That even now, you're still in the game. We needed you to do what you did to set the wheels in motion to save the world. There's a transcendent identity that goes beyond circumstance, that goes beyond as far as the curse is found, as far as we even find ourselves cursing and being cursed, and that is, you are a child of the risen Lord. Christian literally means we are one with the Christ, who, I think, with very precise intent, came to earth as a child and grew to be the man in whose footsteps we still feed his lambs. There is joy in the transcendent identity of one who is God's child like Jesus, and who, like Jesus, carries his name, along with the names that we were born with and are given, carries his name into the world to bring joy, far as it's needed, far as we are able. The transcendent identity of child of God brings joy to the world. Amen.